Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where I've got the deepest voice ever. Last night, the gig went late, didn't get home till late, didn't do the podcast till even later, didn't get to bed till even later. And of course, living that rock star lifestyle that means this morning, I woke up to some banging. Some hard banging, if you know what I mean, that rock star lifestyle. Just banging so hard at my door and screaming, Andy, Andy. And it was like 9 in the morning, which isn't that early. But after such a big night, that's ridiculously early. My buddy's banging at the door. And I'm like, who the hell is this? I drag my ass out of bed, go to the door. And it's my mate and his wife's in labor. And he's all frantic. He's got a dog bed in one arm and a dog in the other. And he's like, you got to look after the dog, man. I got to go. I'm like, okay. So I'm dog sitting at my house. Got a little Shar Pei dog. It's the cutest thing in the world. Big roly-poly skin. It's got way too much skin on its head. It's ridiculous. And that's the big exciting thing that happened to me today. My buddy, well, two of my buddies, really. My buddy and his wife, who's also my buddy. Having a baby, and I'm looking after their dog while they do it. So, hey, fun times, eh? We are here to talk today about a very serious matter, and that is Chapter 5, Part 1 of The Enormous Room, which isn't that serious. I just felt like saying that. Who would you cast in a film of The Enormous Room? I don't think anyone answered that question. I did ask it, but if anyone has an answer, let's talk about it. My mind's a bit blank on that one. I don't have a cast in my head for this, which is a bit of a shame. I wish that the characters popped out in my head as like, ooh, that guy reminds me of this or that, but not so much. Not really. Maybe as the book progresses, we'll start to imagine some characters. What are your thoughts on the character of Auguste? And did you have a favourite line in the chapter? I am Norwegian said, you are not prisoners. Oh no, no indeed. I should say not. Prisoners are not treated like this. You are lucky. Really ramping up that Kafka vibe there, Mr. Surveillant. I did read the chapter a few hours ago, and I don't remember anything about what happened plot-wise. I do remember some of the new characters, though, and that... two of them escaped and will never be seen again. Shrug emoji. I did enjoy today's chapter much more than yesterday's, probably because of the shorter chapter length. Yesterday's chapter was a bit of a drag. But only a bit of a drag. It wasn't too bad. And it also... The previous three chapters before that were quite fast-paced and pretty entertaining. So I'm giving it a pass on that chapter. You know, I'm giving it a... I'm letting it off the hook. Right, I'm willing to give the book a bit more of a chance, although I did get a bit bored in that previous chapter. This is cool. I actually read this comment earlier today. Sometimes I'll go and read the comments during the day. Sometimes I don't get time to do that. Swim said the mum fishy said, I really enjoyed this comment, by the way, Swimmy Fish Face. Why did I like this comment? Because it really did put this book as a whole into a very new context for me. And this is the comment. I don't know. I'm just going to put this out there. I thought that I would enjoy this story more than I am. I am glad that this is a short interlude. I miss that there is no plot. It is interesting, but it just feels blah. I found these remarks on a Library of Congress blog that only increased my antipathy. Luckily for Cummins, his father had connections. He had been Harvard's first instructor in sociology, and in 1917 was perhaps the most famous Unitarian minister in Boston. What does Unitarian mean? Excuse my ignorance. A person, especially a Christian, who asserts the unity of God and rejects the doctrine of the Trinity. Okay. The most famous Unitarian minister in Boston. His plaintive letters, reprinted as the introduction of The Enormous Room, finally succeeded in securing his son's release on December 19th. Worried about his son's seeming lack of direction, Edward Cummings offered a financed trip abroad for his son if he would write up his French notes. And in July 1920, Cummings retired to a tent on Silver Lake in New Hampshire and spent the next 5 months doing just that. Most publishers did not know what to make of the manuscript. It wasn't really a novel or an autobiography, and what was with all the French phrases and the odd typography? After half a dozen rejections, Cummings left the task of finding a publisher to his father, who succeeded in placing it with Boney and Liverat. I am glad that his father insisted that he write his French notes and get it published, because we are better for it to see this slice of World War I, but geez, E.E. Cummings was a pretty privileged snowflake. Right, so I feel like without his father's influence, this book wouldn't have happened, and for a number of reasons. First of all, it probably wouldn't have been written if his father hadn't, not only just funded the writing of it, but funded him to go on a big trip abroad while writing it. So it's essentially like bribing him with a holiday, like, I'll fund a trip to wherever you want to go if you write this book. And so getting paid or giving a living wage to write a book is one thing. A lot of authors have to do that off their own back, sort of thing, you know, like, if I'm going to spend 6 months writing a book, I have to pay for that 6 months of writing that book. So to have that covered, well, that makes it a pretty cushy job. To have that covered and also be able to vacation at the same time, now you're living a pretty luxury. And then he finishes the book and fails to find a publisher because it's a bit sloppy, let's be honest. It's like a poet who has a loose grasp on English grammar and narrative structure, especially the narrative structure. But as this book goes on, I realize structurally it's a bit iffy. And then after all that privilege of getting the book written off someone else's dime, he then gets his very influential father to find a publisher for it after he has failed to do so. So it's not really a success story, is it? I mean, if that was any of our father, anyone listening right now had the same father, we all would have got a book published. And we also would have got an awesome holiday wherever we wanted in the world. So, I don't know. How does that make you feel about the book, knowing that? I mean, I'm enjoying the book, so I'm not trying to rag on the book, but it is amateurish in its prose. And sometimes he turns a really, really nice phrase, and his poetry, I'm sure, wouldn't suffer too much from poor grammar, as poetry doesn't really tend to do. But this novel, it kind of does. All About Alice says, I think this was a difficult chapter to wrap my head around. I agree with the sentiments that there doesn't seem to be much of a plot. I have been curious about the choice of books from Hemingway, the use of French phraseology, of French influence, as a literary device, seems to be pretty prevalent in what we've read so far. That's true, actually, now that you mention it. For Dostoevsky, it makes sense, as at that time French was spoken among the elite of Russian society. And you actually, just on a sideline, you get the same thing with War and Peace, which is also on the list. A lot of French in that book, because French was the spoken language of the upper echelon of Russian high culture at that time in the 1800s. I've seen it before in other works of literature, notably, but not a book we will read, in A Tale of Two Cities. It bounces between French and English. I can't find anything that speaks to why French specifically gets used, or is it just what we've been exposed to? Do other languages get used as a literary device? My best guess is the idea that it is a stab at euphony, use of phrases of notable loveliness. If Cummings is going for euphony, I definitely feel like he's missed the mark. French is a beautiful language, if you can pronounce it. Touché, I definitely can't. And I do apologize every time there's French and I just butcher my way through it. I'm sure that's not exactly pleasant to listen to. There are so many dropped syllables and sounds that you aren't familiar with. Reading it aloud is more chunky than pleasurable. But Hemingway spent time in Paris, so it probably worked for him. More about this chapter. I like that it slowed down a bit. It's a stark contrast to day one and begins to show us the monotony. There isn't really a plot line to being in a detainment centre, if you think about it. Every day is pretty much the same. It is not as fun to read, but it's likely realistic to what E.E. Cummings was going through. Funny that, just on a sideline, that E.E. Cummings often stylized his name to have no capitals. So it was E.E. as if they were initials, but both lowercase, and then Cummings was the lowercase C. So if you see that around the subreddit a lot and wonder why people keep forgetting to capitalize his name, it's because that was kind of how he wrote his own name as a stylized thing. It's kind of like having the backwards R in the band Korn, you know. It's your little trademark flair. So funny thing, I don't know why he did that, but he did do that. Anyway, that's the conversation about the chapter. We're ready to keep reading. So we are going to finish chapter 5, which goes like this. Oh, it starts with some French. Lucky you. Soy mime. Reminds me of a pleasant spirit who graced our little company with a good deal of wit and elegance. He was called by B and myself after a somewhat exciting incident, which I must not describe, but rather outline by the agreeable title of Meme le Belieur. Only a few days after my arrival, the incident in question happened. It seems, I was in La Cour, promenading for the afternoon, that certain more virile inhabitants of the enormous room, among them Harry and Pompom Bien Entendu, declined to se promener and kept their habitat. Now, this was in fulfillment of a little understanding with three or more girls, such as Selena, Lily, and Renee, who, having also declined the promenade, managed in the course of the afternoon to escape from their quarters on the second floor, rush down the hall and upstairs, and gain that landing on which was the only and well-locked door of the enormous room. The next act of this little comedy, or tragedy as it proved for the participants, who got Cabernet and Payne sick, male and female alike, for numerous days thereafter, might well be entitled Love Will Find a Way. Just how the door was opened, a lock picked, etc. from the inside is, of course, a considerable mystery to anyone possessing a limited acquaintance with the art of burglary. Anyway, it was accomplished. And that in several fifths of a second. Now let the curtain fall, and the reader be satisfied with the significant word asbestos, which is part of all first-rate performances. The surveillant, I fear, distrusted his belieur. Belieurs were always being changed, because belieurs were, in shameful contrast to the plantons, invariably human beings. For this deplorable reason, they inevitably carried notes to and from between La Homme and La Femme, upon which ground the belieur, in this case a well-knit, keen-eyed, agile man with a sense of humour and a sharp perception of men, women, and things in particular, and in general, we call before the bar of an impromptu court held by M. Le Surveillant in the enormous room after the promenade. I shall not enter into detail into the nature of the charges pressed in certain cases, but confine myself to quoting the close of a peroration which would have done Demosthenes credit. Meme la balure a tire un coup. The individual in question mildly deprecated M. Le Surveillant's opinion, while the audience roared and rocked with laughter of a somewhat ferocious sort. I have rarely seen the surveillant so pleased with himself as after producing this bon mot. Only fear of his superior, the ogre-like directeur, kept him from letting off entirely, all concerned in what, after all, from the European point of view, was an essentially human proceeding. As nobody could prove anything about Mimi, he was not locked up in the dungeon, but he lost his job of sweeper, which was quite as bad, I am sure, from his point of view, and from that day became a common inhabitant of the enormous room like any of the rest of us. His successor, Garibaldi, was a corker. How the almighty French government in its almighty wisdom ever found Garibaldi a place among us is more than I understand or ever will. He was a little tot in a faded blue-grey French uniform, and when he perspired he pushed a kippie up and back from his worried forehead, which a lock of heavy hair threateningly overhung. As I recollect Gabrioldi's terribly difficult, not to say complicated lineage, his English mother had presented him to his Italian father in the country of France. However this trilogy may be, he had served at various times in the Italian, French, and English armies, as there was, unless we call Gariboldi Italian, which he obviously was not, nary a subject of King Ponzi, or Caruso, or whatever be his name, residing at La Ferte Macci. Gariboldi was in the habit of expressing himself chiefly at the card table, be it said, in a curious language which might have been mistaken for French. To be and me he spoke an equally curious language, but a perfectly recognisable one, i.e. Cockney Whitechapel English. He showed us a perfectly authentic mission card, which certified that his family had received a pittance from some charitable organisation situated in the Whitechapel neighbourhood, and that moreover they were in the habit of receiving this pittance, and that finally their claim to such pittance was amply justified by the poverty of their circumstances. Beyond this valuable certificate, Gariboldi, which everyone called him, attained great incoherence. He had been wronged. He was always being misunderstood. His life had been a series of mysterious tribulations. I, for one, have the merest idea that Gariboldi was arrested for the theft of some peculiarly worthless trifle, and sent to the limbo of the La Ferte as a penance. This merest idea is suggested by something which happened with the clever man instituted at search for his missing knife, but I must introduce the clever man to my reader before describing the rather beguiling incident. Conceive a tall, well-dressed, rather athletic, carefully kept, clean and neat, intelligent, not for a moment despondent, altogether superior man, fairly young, perhaps 29, and quite bald. He wins enough every night at Bon Cue to enable him to pay the less fortunate to perform his corvée due for him. As a consequence, he takes his vile coffee in bed every morning, then smokes a cigarette or two lazily, then drops off for a nap, and gets up about the middle of the morning promenade. Upon arising, he stops a razor of his own, nobody knows how he gets away with a regular razor, carefully lathers his face and neck, while gazing into a rather classy mirror which he hangs night and day over his head, above a little shelf on which he displays, at such times, a complete toilet outfit, and proceeds to annihilate the inconsiderable growth of a beard, which his mirror reveals to him. Having completed the annihilation, he performs the most extensive ablutions per one of the three or four pails which the enormous room boasts, which pail is by common consent dedicated to his personal and exclusive use. All this time he has been singing loudly and musically the following sumptuously imaginative ditty: "Meet me tonight in dreamland under the silvery moon. Meet me in dreamland, sweet dreamy dreamland. There all my dreams come true." His English accent is excellent. He pronounces his native language, which is the language of the Hollanders, crisply and firmly. He is not given to Govterdooming. In addition to Dutch and English, he speaks French clearly and Belgian distinctly. I dare say he knows half a dozen languages in all. He gives me the impression of a man who could never be at a loss in whatever circumstances he might find himself, a man capable of extricating himself from the most difficult situation, and that with the greatest ease. A man who bides his time and improves the present by separating one after the other, his moneyed fellow prisoners from their banknotes. He is by all odds the coolest player that I have ever watched. Nothing worries him. If he loses 200 francs tonight, I am sure he will win it, and 50 in addition tomorrow. He accepts opponents without distinction, the stupid, the wily, the vain, the cautious, the desperate, the hopeless. He has not the slightest pity, not the least fear. In one of my numerous notebooks I have this perfectly direct paragraph. Card table. Four stairs play bank with two cigarettes, one dead, and a pipe, the clashing faces yanked by a leanness of one candle, bottle stuck, birth of X, where sits the clever man who pyramids, sings, mornings, meet me. Which specimen of the telegraphic technique being interpreted means Judas Gabriel Gabriel Baldi and the Holland skipper, whom the reader will meet de suite. Gabriboldi's cigarette having gone out, so greatly is he absorbed, play bank for the four intent and highly focused individuals who may or may not be the schoolmaster, Monsieur Auguste, the barber, and Mimi, with the clever man, as nearly always, acting as banker. The candle by whose somewhat uncorpulent illumination the various physiognomies are yanked into a ferocious unity is stuck into the mouth of a bottle. The lighting of the whole, the rhythmic disposition of the figures, construct a sensuous integration, suggestive of the birth of Christ by one of the old masters. The clever man, having had his usual morning warble, is extremely quiet. He will win. He pyramids, and he pyramids because he has the cash and can afford to make every play a big one. All he needs is the rake of a croupier to complete his disinterested and wholly nervous poise. He is a born gambler, is the clever man, and I dare say that to play cards in time of war constituted a heinous crime, and I am certain that he played cards before he arrived at La Ferté. Excuse me. Moreover, I suppose that to win at cards in time of war is an unutterable crime, and I know that he has won at cards before in his life, so now we have a perfectly good and valid explanation of the presence of the clever man in our midst. The clever man's chief opponent was Judas. It was a real pleasure to us whenever of an evening Judas sweated and mopped and sweated and lost more and more and was finally cleaned out. But the skipper, I learned from certain prisoners who escorted the baggage of the clever man from the enormous room when he left us one day, as he did for some reason to enjoy the benefits of freedom, paid the mastermind of the card table 150 francs at the gate, poor skipper, upon whose vacant bed lay down luxuriously the lobster, immediately to be wheeled fiercely all around the enormous room by the guard, Champetre, and Judas, to the boisterous plaudits of tout le monde. But I started to tell about the afternoon when the mastermind lost his knife, and tell it I will forthwith. B and I were lying prone upon our respective beds when, presto, a storm arose at the further end of the enormous room. We looked and beheld the clever man, thoroughly and efficiently angry, addressing, threatening, and frightening generally a constantly increasing group of fellow prisoners. After dismissing, with a few sharp linguistic cracks of the whip, certain theories which seemed to be advanced by the bolder auditors with a view to palliating, persuading, and tranquillizing his just wrath, he made for the nearest palace, turned it topsy-turvy, slit it neatly from stem to stem with a jackknife, banged the hay about, and then went with careful haste through the pitiful minute baggage of the palace owner. Silence fell. No one, least of all the owner, said anything. From this bed the clever man turned to the next, treated it in the same fashion, searched it thoroughly, and made for the third. His motions were those of a perfectly oiled machine. He proceeded up the length of the room, varying his procedure only by sparing an occasional mattress, throwing palaises about, tumbling sacks and boxes inside out, his face somewhat paler than usual, but otherwise immaculate and expressionless. B and I waited with some interest to see what would happen to our belongings. Arriving at our beds, he paused, seemed to consider a moment, then, not touching our palaises proper, proceeded to open our duffel bags and hunt half-heartedly, remarking that somebody might have put it in, and so passed on. "What in hell is the matter with that guy?" I asked of Fritz, who stood near us with a careless air, some scorn and considerable amusement in his eyes. "The bloody fool's lost his knife," was Fritz's answer. After completing his rounds, the clever man searched almost everywhere except ourselves and Fritz, and absolutely subsided on his own palais, muttering occasionally, "If he found it, what he'd do." I think he never did find it. It was a beautiful knife, John the Baigneur said. "What did it look like?" I demanded with some curiosity. "It had a naked woman on the handle," Fritz said, his eyes sharp with amusement. And everyone agreed that it was a great pity that the clever man had lost it, and everyone began timidly to restore order and put his personal belongings back in place and say nothing at all. But what amused me was to see that the little tot in a bluish-grey French uniform, Gabrioli, who about when the search approached his palais suddenly hurried over to B, his perspiring forehead more perspiring than usual, his kepi set at an angle of insanity, and hurriedly presented B with a long-lost German silver folding camp knife purchased by B from a fellow member of Wing et Un, who was known to us as Lord Algy, a lanky, effeminate, brittle, spotless creature who was en route to becoming an officer and whose finicky tastes the fat jowled A tirelessly pandered for doubtless financial considerations with Schneif accordingly to the trembling and altogether miserable Gabrioli had been found by him that day in the corps, which is eminently and above all things curious, as the treasure had been lost weeks before. Which again brings us to the skipper, whose elaborate couch has already been mentioned. He was a Hollander, and one of the strongest, most gentle, and altogether most pleasant of men, who used to sit on the water wagon under the shed in the corps and smoke his pipe quietly of an afternoon, his stocky, even tightly knit person in the heavy trousers and jersey sweater culminated in a bronze face, which was at once kind and firm, a piece of supernatural work as I think I ever knew. His voice was agreeably modulated. He was utterly without affectation. He had three sons. One evening a number of gendarmes came to his house and told him that he was arrested. So my three sons and I threw them all out of the window into the canal. I can still see the opening smile, squared kindness of cheeks, eyes, little cool keys, his heart always with the sea. The little machine fixer, Le Petit Bonhomme avec le bras cassé, as he styled himself, referred to his little paralyzed left arm. He was perfectly different, that I must let you see him next. He was slightly taller than Garibaldi, about the size of Monsieur Auguste. He and Monsieur Auguste together were a fine sight, a sight which made me feel that I came to a race of giants. I am afraid it was more or less as giants that B and I pitied the machine fixer. Still, this was not really our fault, since the machine fixer came to us with his troubles, much as a very minute and helpless child comes to a very large and omnipotent one. And God knows we did not only pity him, we liked him. And if we could in some often ridiculous manner assist the machine fixer, I think we nearly always did. The assistant to which I refer was wholly spiritual, since the minute machine fixer's colossal self-pride eliminated any possibility of material assistance. What we did, about every other night, was to entertain him, as we entertained our other friends. Cher knew, that is to say, he would come up late every evening or every other evening, and after his day's toil, for he worked as co-sweeper with Garibaldi, and he was a tremendous worker. Never have I seen a man who took his work so seriously and made so much of it, to sit with great care and very respectfully upon one or the other of our beds at the upper end of the enormous room and smoke a black small pipe, talking excitedly and strenuously and fiercely about La Miserie, and himself and ourselves, often crying a little but very bitterly, and from time to time striking matches with a short, angry gesture on the sole of his big, almost square boot. His little, abrupt, conscientious, relentless, difficult self lived always in a single dimension, the somewhat beautiful dimension of sorrow. He was a Belgian, and one of two Belgians in whom I have ever felt the least or slightest interest, for the machine fixer might have been a Polack, or an idol, or an Eskimo, as so far as his nationality affected his soul. By and large, that was the trouble, the machine fixer had a soul. Put the bracelets on an ordinary man, tell him he's a bad egg, treat him rough, shove him into the jug, or its equivalent. You see, I have no regard always for M. Le Surveillance delicate, but no doubt necessary distinction between the furt and prison, and he will become one of three animals, a rabbit, that is to say timid, a mole, that is to say stupid, or a hyena, that is to say Harry the Hollander. But if by some fatal, some incomparably fatal accident, this man has a soul, ah, then we have the truly most horribly what is called in La Ferté Mêche by those who have known it, La Miserie. Monsieur Auguste's valiant attempts at cheerfulness and the natural buoyancy of his gentle disposition, in a slight degree protected from the La Miserie, the machine fixer was lost. By nature he was tremendously sensible. He was the very apotheosis of l'âme sensible. In fact, his sensibility made him shoulder not only the inexhaustible injustice which he had suffered, but the incomparable and overwhelming total injustice which everyone had suffered and was suffering en masse day and night in the enormous room. His woes, had they not sprung from perfectly real causes, might have suggested a persecution complex. As it happened, there was no possible method of relieving them. They could be relieved in only one way, by liberty, not simply by the personal liberty, but by the liberation of every single fellow captive as well. His extraordinary personal anguish could not be selfishly appeased by a merely partial righting. In his own case of the wrong, the ineffable and terrific and to be perfectly avenged wrong done to those who ate and slept and wept and played cards with him, that abominable and unyielding symbol which enclosed the immutable vileness of our common life. It was necessary for its appeasement that a shaft of bright lightning suddenly and entirely should wither the human and material structures which stood always between our filthy and pitiful selves and the unspeakable cleanness of liberty. B recalls that the little machine fixer said or hinted that he had been either a socialist or an anarchist when he was young, so that is doubtless why he had the privilege of his society. After all, it's highly improbable that this poor socialist suffered more at the hands of the great and good French government than did many a conscientious objector at the hands of the great and good American government, or, since all great governments are per se good and vice versa, than did many a man in general who was cursed with a talent for thinking during the warlike moments recently past, during, that is to say, an epoch when the G and G nations demanded of their respective peoples the exact antithesis to thinking, said antithesis being vulgarly called belief, lest which statement prejudice some members of the American Legion in disfavor of the machine fixer, or rather of myself, awful thought. I hasten to assure everyone that the machine fixer was a highly moral person. His morality was at times almost gruesome, as when he got started on the inhabitants of the women's quarters. Be it understood that the machine fixer was human, that he would take a letter, provided he liked the sender, and deliver it to the sender's adoree without a murmur. That was simply a good deed done for a friend. It did not imply that he approved of the friend's choice, which for strictly moral reasons he invariably, and to the friend's very face, violently deprecated. To this little man, or perhaps of perhaps 45, with a devoted wife waiting for him in Belgium, a wife whom he worshipped and loved more than he worshipped and loved anything in the world, a wife whose fidelity to her husband and whose trust and confidence in him echoed in the letters which, when we three were alone, the little machine fixer tried always to read to us, never getting beyond the first sentence or two before he broke down and sobbed from his feet to his eyes. To such a little person, his reaction to La Femme was more than natural. It was, in fact, inevitable. Women, to him at least, were of two kinds, and two kinds only. There were La Femme Hornets, and there were Les Putains. In La Ferté, he informed us, and as Ballieu, he ought to have known whereof he spoke, there were as many as three ladies of the former variety. One of them he talked with often. She told him her story. She was a Russian of a very fine education, living peacefully in Paris up to the time that she wrote to her relatives a letter containing the following treasonable sentiment: Je m'ennuie pour les niches de Russie. The letter had been read by the French censor, as had B's letter, and her arrest and transference from her home in Paris to La Ferté-Macé promptly followed. She was as intelligent as she was virtuous, and had nothing to do with her frailer sisters. So the machine fixer informed us with a quickly passing flash of joy, which sisters his little forehead knotted itself, and his big bushy eyebrows plunged together wrathfully. Were wicked and indecent, and utterly despicable disgraces to their sex. And this relentless Joseph fiercely and jerkily related how, only the day before, he had repulsed the painfully obvious solicitations of Madame Potiphar by turning his back like a good Christian upon temptation and marching out of the room, broom tightly clutched in a virtuous hand. Monsieur Jean, meaning myself, servez-vous, with a terrific gesture which consisted in snapping his thumbnail between his teeth. Capu. Then he added, and what would my wife say to me if I came home to her and presented her with that which this creature had presented to me? They are animals, cried the little machine fixer. All they want is a man. They don't care who he is. They want a man, but they won't get me. And he warned us to beware. Especially interesting, not to say valuable, was the machine fixer's testimony concerning the more or less regular inspections, which were held by the same doctor who had examined me in the course of my first day at La Ferté, for La Femme, presumably in the interest of public safety. La Femme, quoth the machine fixer, who had been many times an eyewitness of this proceeding, lined up, talking and laughing and crime of crimes, smoking cigarettes outside the bureau of M. Le Médecin Major. Une femme entrée, elle s'est levée, les jupes jusqu'au menton, etc. Met sur le banc, and Médecin Major la regarde, il dit dessus, bon, c'est tout. Elle sort un autre, entre la même chose, bon, c'est fini, monsieur, je ne peux garder. And he struck a match fiercely on the black, almost square boot, which lived on the end of his little worn trouser leg, bending his small body forward as he did so and bringing the flame upwards in a violent curve. The flame settled on his little black pipe, his cheeks sucked until they must have met, and a slow, unwilling noise arose, and with the return of his cheeks, a small colourless wisp of possibly smoke came from the air. That's not tobacco. Do you know what it is? It's wood. And I sit here smoking wood in my pipe when my wife is sick with worrying. Monsieur Jean, leaning forward with jaw protruding and a oneness of bristly eyebrows. C'est grand, monsieur, qu'il ne faut pas mal si l'on crève de faim. Souvez, ils croient chazou quill et le bon dieu le mumeur machine, souvez son tort. Leaning right into my face, the withered hand making a pitiful fist of itself. Ils sont des crapules. I'm going to assume that because he's written whole paragraphs in another language, that those paragraphs don't matter. Because if he's assuming that all people that speak English also speak French, he's dumb. He's dumb. And his ghastly and toy-like wizened and minute arm would try to make a pass at their lofty lives. Oh, gouvernement français, I think it was not very clear of you to put this terrible doll in La Ferté. I should have left him in Belgium with his little doll wife if I hadn't been you. For when governments had found dead, there is always a little doll on the top of them, pulling and tweaking with his little hands to get back the microscopic knife which sticks firmly in the quiet meat of his hearts. One day only did I see him happy or nearly happy, when a Belgian baroness for some reason arrived and was bowed and fed and wined by the delightfully respectful and perfectly behaved official captors. And I know of her in Belgium. She is a great lady. She is very powerful and she is generous. I fell on my knees before her and implored her in the name of my wife and Le Bon Dieu to intercede in my behalf. And she has made a note of it. And she told me she would write, the Belgian king and I will be free in a few weeks. Free. The little machine fixer, I happen to know, did finally leave La Ferté for Précigne. In the kitchen worked a very remarkable person, who were sabots, and sang continuously in a very subdued way to himself as he stirred the huge black kettles. We, that is to say, B and I, became acquainted with Afrique very gradually. You did not know Afrique suddenly, you became cognizant of Afrique gradually. And you were in the cour, staring at ooze and dead trees, when a figure came striding from the kitchen, lifting its big wooden feet after it rhythmically, unwinding a patchouli-coloured scarf from its waist as it came, and singing to itself in a subdued manner a jocular and, I fear, unprintable ditty concerning paradise. The figure entered a little gate to the cour in a businesslike way, unwinding continuously and made stridingly for the cabinet, situated up against the stone wall which separated the promenading sexes, dragging behind it on the ground a tail of ever-increasing dimensions. The cabinet reached, tail and figure partly parted company, the former fell inert to the limitless mud, the latter disappeared into the contrivance of a jack-in-the-box rapidity, from which contrivance the continuing ditty, La Paradis est une maison, or again, it's a lithe pausing poise, intensely intelligent, certainly sensitive, delivering dryingly a series of sure and rapid hints that penetrate the fabric of stupidity accurately and whisperingly, dealing one after another brief and poignant in stupidities, distinct and uncompromising, crisp and altogether arrow-like. The poise has a cigarette in its hand, which cigarette it has just pausingly rolled from material. Has he had a stroke? Has the author of this book had a stroke? Let me just read this paragraph again. Or again, it's a lithe, pausing poise, intensely intelligent, certainly sensitive, delivering dryingly, not a word, a series of sure and rapid hints that penetrate the fabric of stupidity accurately and whisperingly, dealing one after another brief and poignant instupidities, distinct and uncompromising, crisp and altogether arrow-like. The poise has a cigarette in its hand, which cigarette it has just pausingly rolled from material furnished by a number of carefully saved butts, whereof Afrique's pockets are invariably full. It's neither old nor young, but rather keen face hoards a pair of greyish-blue witty eyes, which face and eyes are directed upon us through the open door of a little room, which little room is in the rear of the cuisine, a little room filled with an inexpressibly clean and soft odour of newly cut wood, which wood we are pretending to split and pile for kindling. As a matter of fact, we are enjoying a freak's conversation, escaping from the bleak and profoundly muddy cour, and under the watchful auspices of the cook who plays sentinel, drinking something approximating coffee with something approximating sugar therein, all this because the cook thinks we're bouches, and being the cook and a bouche lim fem lu meme is consequently peculiarly concerned for our welfare. Frick is talking about les journaux and to what prodigious pains they go to not tell the truth. Or he is telling how a native stole up on him in the night, armed with a spear 2 meters long once on a time in a certain part of the world. Or he is predicting that the Germans will march upon the French by the way of Switzerland. Or he is teaching us to count and swear in Arabic. Or he is having a very good time in the Midi as a tinker, sleeping under a tree outside a little town. Afrique is an alert kind of mind, which has been and seen and observed and penetrated all known, a bit there, somewhat here, chiefly everywhere, its specialty being politics, in which case Afrique has had the inestimable advantage of observing without being observed, until the furt whereupon Afrique goes on uninterruptedly observing, recognizing that a significant angle of observation has been presented to him gratis. Les journaux and politics in general are topics upon which Afrique can say more without the slightest fatigue than a book as big as my two thumbs. Why, yes, they got water, and then I gave them coffee, monsieur, or more properly, mine here. The chef is expostulating. The planton is stupidly protesting that we are supposed to be upstairs. Afrique is busily stirring a huge black pot, winking gravely at us and singing softly, Le bon Dieu sol comme un cochon. All right, there we go. Whatever that was, we've read it. Yeah, I don't even know what to say about that. In one ear and out the other, a little bit. Bit of this book is sliding downhill for me, I've got to admit. Like, what was that chapter about? What was that chapter about? Anyway, I'm not giving up on this book. You know, I'm still going to say I could still reflect back on this book and say, yeah, that was a good book. I enjoyed it. But these last two chapters have been a weird, weird couple of chapters. The pace of it, the flow of it is just all out of whack. Anyway, doesn't matter. Have your say over at Reddit. And I look forward to seeing what you guys have to say about it. Thanks for listening today. I'll see ya tomorrow.